meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will come to order. It is Thursday, February 17th, 2011. And this morning on our agenda, we have the budget presentation, the governor's budget. And here to present it is our commissioner of MMB, Jim Showalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for the delay. Happy to be here. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, commissioner of management and budget. With me are a number of members of management and budget team. We have a slideshow here for you, available for any questions on the governor's budget. My hopes is the slideshow will work better than the presentation at the Department of Revenue when it sort of all went black on me. Madam Chair, members, governor's recommendations for fiscal year 12 and 13 are intended to address a series of issues that face the state. I don't think there are any surprise to anybody here. We have $6.2 billion deficit. We have structural balance problems from here into 14-15 and into the future. There's demographic issues. Plenty of questions that need to be addressed. How to deal with oncoming federal health care reform, making sure we have an effective, well-trained state government so that services are effective and worth the price of the taxes. All of those challenges are what Governor Dayton worked through. About a month ago, we started sitting down day after day, hour after hour, line item by line item, trying to figure out what are the options. As you and your colleagues have already started to do and will continue to do over the next months, you'll see that there are a lot of very difficult choices. The governor's approach is a comprehensive look, taking all those trade-offs into account and trying to find some way to make sure that Minnesota has a fair, balanced, and responsible approach to deal with this $6.2 billion deficit and maintain the competitive advantages and the service levels that Minnesota has become accustomed to. And some of those issues that he's trying to address are really from the last several years. We all know that the recession had a significant impact on the state. It had an impact on the jobs, had an impact on the revenues as a result of the state and the overall economy that we're facing. Those revenues aren't coming back. Sitting in the Council of Economic Advisors meetings the last, frankly, couple of years, we sometimes hoped or asked whether the recession would end like some of the recessions in the 80s or 70s, where you go down and all of a sudden the growth rate just springs back up. It's known as sort of a V-shaped recovery. Unfortunately, this is more like a shell-shaped recovery, which is sort of slow and gradual coming back out. And so that the revenue growth that we're anticipating in the forecast, that almost every national economic forecaster is expecting, and certainly what's being borne out by our experience, is that things will be very gradual. So we're going to have to make adjustments. We're going to have to make them this year. We're going to have to make them this budget. The governor's proposal includes about a 12.7% increase in revenues from the November forecast, about a 5% decrease in expenditures from forecast as well. You'll find very, very little in one-time nature. It's really based on a pretty straight-up approach to budgeting. You're not going to see interfund transfers, like new kinds of mechanisms that will take money out of dedicated funds and move it into the general fund. There's only one fee in the entire general fund budget for one dedicated purpose, less than $500,000 total. It's really based on a straight-up look on tax revenues, expenditures of the state, and a careful review of each and what are the issues and what are the opportunities.
Sure.
Senator Magnus.
Commissioner Showalter, could you tell me about those fees again? You said there's one fee increase?
Madam Chair, Senator, it is in the Department of Agriculture. find it if you would like. It was a food inspection fee, if I remember.
I know what it is. I was just wondering if...
The retail handler's fee, I hear.
Right. I was just wondering...
Magnus?
Madam Chair, I was just wondering if we were the only ones that had the fee, because I knew we had it, and
yep.
I didn't know if we were the lucky ones that had the only one. So.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner, could I ask a question?
Yes.
In the November forecast, I don't remember revenues being that high. I thought it was really close to just $32 billion. Was it always 32,443?
Madam Chair, I don't think there's 3240. Is there an adjustment? Okay. For simplicity, basically it's a redistributing the revenues on the early MA. Some of that was shown in the forecast as a net figure on the net spending rather than breaking it up into its expenditure and revenue components. The net impact is the same in these numbers, but basically at that point we didn't have the pieces appropriately broken away, and so that's what you're seeing here.
Thank you.
So what you see here is a plan to approach the $6.2 billion. Overarching, this is really trying to make sure that we hold on to a series of proposals that are achievable and clear and really directed at the state resolving its own problems. On this slide, you'll see some of the more specific items that were detailed and discussed briefly at the governor's announcement of his budget and will continue to be discussed in committee, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. Overall, what you're seeing here, again, is a mix of spending and revenue changes. It's, I think, always difficult to shift from the very, very high level of what is the expected mix of revenues and expenditures, and then getting to the detailed level of saying, specifically, how do you build up to that level of revenue? How do you build up to that level of cuts? And that's a challenge that the governor experienced, and I think that is a challenge that the legislature will experience as well, as you may have ideal balance, levels of balance between those two features, but it is a very difficult process to get there. As we went through this, you'll see we started with, on the top of this chart, the shift buyback. That was from last session. It's not a new shift. It's basically recognizing that we are not in position to pay back about $1.4 billion this biennium. The governor does want to make sure that schools understand that this will be paid back, and it's not going to be based on just the forecast repayment mechanism, which is already in statute. That will remain, but he also wants to start making sure that each year 10% of that shift is paid back starting in 2014, so that one way or another we build that into our obligations and start to pay that back. Beyond that,
Madam Chair.
Senator Langston.
I'm not sure this is the time to ask it, but you know, in January, the revenues were up $137 million. I guess I can't remember a month that was that good, and that came from withholding, which indicates there's either more people working or people are working longer or both. And Mr. Tom Hansen, who is never, never wrong, has indicated that the forecast would show us up $500 million. Well, the $137 million in 1 month indicates that may be light. Is the governor going to come with a supplement after the forecast if it changes the fair amount?
Madam Chair, Senator, the governor certainly will adjust his budget based upon the upcoming forecast. I would like to go to the side of euphoria, but as Commissioner of MMB, that's just pretty much not allowed. And I don't think really right now the data is there to even suggest that. It isn't just withholding. In fact, withholding is pretty much straight on based upon the most recent items. It's estimated payments that have been received. So what could be happening, but we don't know, and that's really what Tom Stinson and the economists are looking at, is whether people are starting to pay some of their tax liability for this fiscal year or this tax year a little bit early so that they don't have bigger tax bills due in April, or whether, in fact, the economy is going gangbusters and, in fact, there's more income going on out there. And so people are paying on their normal rate, and we would assume that the state would, achieve much higher revenues than anticipated. Commissioner Hansen's usually right on these things, so I would still go to the side of caution on any monthly revenue numbers.
So, Madam Chair, additional items here include about $1 billion in permanent expenditure reductions. We'll talk about some of those changes and some of the items in a little bit. There are some new expenditures. We'll also go in detail those in a bit. Of that 465, however, I do want to note that about $265 million of that is related to the Medicaid surcharges. By breaking up the revenues and the expenditures on this chart, you see the impact of some of the increased rates that are there to help soften the impact of some of the surcharges on provider groups. So while you see a larger revenue item here on the healthcare surcharges, that's a gross number. That's the revenue side. The expenditure part is built into that new expenditure line. So don't be misled that there's $465 million in new initiatives, so much as that almost half of that is related to one of the revenue items.
Commissioner, did you build in new expenditures anywhere the tax conformancy, which is almost $300 million? Is that included in this budget?
The tax conformity provisions for fiscal 11, are you referring to?
For the upcoming biennium, the federal tax conformancy that had been removed because the federal laws were expiring, but I understand they, if we want to conform with them, then we have to put them back in.
There are a number of federal tax conformity provisions that are included in the governor's specific recommendations, and they would roll up into this chart. They would be, I think, all impacted on the revenue side, though, not necessarily on the spending side. Mm-hmm. Trying to see if there's any, which category this would go into. In the 2011 deficiencies tax conformity line, you see some of the net impact built into that line. And to the extent there's 12 and 13 impacts, they'd be built in above that.
Do you know how much that amount is? Because we understand that in order to do all of them that had been in place previously, it would be nearly $300 million.
Madam Chair, certainly there are a number of places where tax conformity could add up into that list. The governor specifically reviewed each of those and chose some items where he felt it was in the state's interest and, frankly, could afford federal tax conformity, and other places where it chose not to. So that is part of the specific recommendations that are here. We can certainly follow up afterwards to just go through that list to make sure we're comparing the same items. I've got some of the items here in front of me if you want. Okay.
Was the one related to marriage, the benefit for married couples included in it?
Madam Chair, I don't believe that is included in the recommendations. The total impact in fiscal 11 was about $23 million of essentially lost revenue to the state associated with conformity, another about $24 million in fiscal 12, a net small gain of $5 million in 2013. Some of the items that were recommended include some of the items regarding Small Business Jobs Act, tax relief, UI job recreation, some on the corporate side, Small Business Job Act. So those are some of the items that are included here. There are a number of other items on page 22 of the revenue book that you can see the change page that lists out some of the items that are included, some of the items that are not included.
So some people would consider, if those tax conformancies don't stay in place, it would be a tax increase for those people not being able to benefit from them. Is that not correct?
Madam
Chair,
tax
increase?
On the basically changes in the federal law, I think the question is whether the legislature and the governor want to recommend in terms of changes in the state law. We work off the baseline of current law. And as the federal law will swing back and forth, that is, I think, the Congress's jurisdiction. How we want to respond to that, we can or cannot conform, and that is always, every year, a set of choices. We don't conform to everything that's in the federal tax code.
Commissioner, I understand that because we didn't conform to some of them that are, I believe, in the governor's budget, the educator's credit. There were several others that we have not conformed to for the last 4 years. I think he put them in, but it appears from these figures that he took a great deal of them out that we were conforming with in the past. And people have had ongoing conformancy in those areas because even though the federal tax cuts were going to expire, they never did. So people have continued with those reductions, but now the state would not under the governor's proposal.
Madam Chair, as you well know, Congress has the ability to extend these tax code changes and not necessarily recognize the impacts on states and the revenues that may or may not be impacted here. In trying to balance the budget, the governor was able to conform to some of those federal provisions, not all of them at this point.
Senator Magnus.
To that point, Madam Chair, I thought in your bill that passed the legislature and the governor vetoed, do we have the Section 179 conformity in that bill?
Senator Magnus, we did have it in there for all of the ones that were applicable to 2010.
Right, for 20 and 10.
Correct. It's for all of them that were ongoing and conformed with the federal laws.
Madam Chair, I would ask Commissioner Showalter, is that included in the budget, that provision, the Section 179?
Madam Chair, Senator, we'll have to, I'm not sure, and we're going to check with the Department of Revenue just to make sure on that provision.
Well, Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair, when I read the governor's veto letter, I kind of took it that he was going to do that. It was pretty clear in the letter he was going to do the conformity. So I was, I'd be surprised if it's not in the budget. But if you could get back to me, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Senator, I just don't want to give you information that I'm not sure of. So tax conformity issues can be somewhat tricky. And so that I'm speaking with a clear voice, I would like to just, Mike will make a quick call and we'll make sure we get back to you.
And Madam Chair,
Senator Magnus.
That's one of the reasons why I supported taking action we did at the time we did, because for example, the farmers have to have their income tax is done by March 1st for last year. And the small businesses, the other portion of that 179 compliance needed can go till April. But, timing is key here. We got to get this going, or we're going to continue to do tax returns, and we're going to continue to pay our counters more money to be doing all these tax returns. So.
And, Madam Chair, Senator, I know that the governor is interested in finding a way to deal with the fiscal year 10, or fiscal year 11, I'm sorry, tax conformity issues. And I remember that was part of that letter. So I know the Department of Revenue is actually testifying in front of the Tax Committee at this particular moment, but we'll get that information to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
So the budget, as you start to look at it by committee area, you'll see a number of different figures. This is just really to help orient each of you to some of those figures as you break the governor's budget recommendations and for a starting point in your budget deliberations. The priorities in his recommendations are pretty clear. He wanted to make sure that education funding was stable and increasing. And while with a $6.2 billion deficit, that really increasing is a difficult task, he was able to put small increases of expenditures into that area for both fiscal years of the biennium while holding it harmless from overall net cuts. The new expenditures are really targeted in just a couple of areas, focused on early education as well as educational achievement and initiatives. Another area where the governor held off of potential budget reductions were the local aids and credits area, where he recommended no reductions to local government aids and county program aids. The net impact of some of those reductions, as he was talking it through, were impacts that would extend some of the trends that we've seen in local property taxes, and he wanted to make sure that the state didn't induce further changes in property taxes. We talked about different ways of trying to make sure that property taxes didn't get impacted. And, in the end, his recommendation were to hold those harmless to make sure that those clearly, as a regressive source of revenue, wasn't added into the mix of the overall budget context.
Commissioner, in the health and human services cuts, Are not some of those to county programs that they may end up levying for or raising their taxes in order to continue to provide those services?
Madam Chair, absolutely. There are some. The counties and the state do business on a number of different levels in health and human services in particular, and there are some reductions in that area where counties will face the choice of curtailing some of the activities, deciding to take those responsibilities up. Overall, I think those impacts are pretty relatively small compared with the impact of some of the funds that go through the property tax aids and credit area. But there certainly are a number of interactions between the state budget and county budget.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, of the HHS cuts, how much of that is nursing homes? Do you have a total number for that?
Chair, Ms. Senator, I can look it up real quick. There's a lot of difficult choices in the health and human services area, and Commissioner Jessen is here, and we'll go through some of those in a minute. I'll give you the answer to this question, but we can go into a little bit more detail on health and human services in a minute, if that would be acceptable. The reduction on nursing homes, I believe, is a rate reduction at about the 2% level. I'm trying to find the figure for you. And the impact for a nursing facility and ICF,
Madam Chair, and group homes also, are they got reduced too?
There are rate reductions. There's a number of, there's a number of rate reductions. As you may know, the context in health and human services is a difficult one to manage because of some of the maintenance of effort requirements, because of the mandated eligibility and, how do you approach these costs. So, yes, there are some rate reductions. I believe that there are 4.5% rate reduction in the community care area. Very difficult choices, even as we're trying to find savings. And I know many people would argue there should be more savings. Those are some of the very difficult reductions that the governor had to walk through and assess. How far can he really go in order to achieve the kinds of fiscal savings that people would expect? So, Madam Chair, you'll see reductions in the higher education area to each of the systems, reductions of about 6% in their state funding. As you know, state funding is about half of their overall funding levels.
Senator Hand had a question.
Madam Chair, and I just wanted to comment or ask, get your comment on going back to the Health and Human Services section. Has the governor expressed any interest, desire, or been aggressively seeking opportunities from the federal government to do things differently than what is required by federal law? It seems to me that given the constraints that the federal law has placed on us with the money, that it would be wise for us to, rather than just continue to do the things that you're proposing, to go and seek what, for example, Rhode Island has done, which is to get essentially an opportunity to structure their Medicaid plans in the way that they see fit. And why wouldn't we do that? And why wouldn't the governor use his relationship with the federal government to do that? I think when I met with the governor, I asked him about this personally, that we're only the second state that has opted to expand Medicaid voluntarily. It would seem to me that that would give us some leverage with the federal government to say maybe as a condition of that, we ought to be given some opportunity to do it the way we want to. Has that been explored? Is that going to be a part of what we're able to do, or is that just not going to happen?
Chair Showalter.
Chair, Senator, excellent question. And at the core of the question is the growing interrelationship between the federal government and the state government, particularly in the health and human services area. When Commissioner Jessen comes up, there are a number of places where we are going to have to ask for waivers or some kind of agreement with the federal government in order to implement the very recommendations you see before you. I do want to note, having started part of my state service as a budget officer in the healthcare area, I know that the notion of the federal government giving leniency usually, in the past at least, has been a mixed bag. When I watched Tennessee and some of their experiments in getting leniency and ability to do 10 care, it has since sort of fallen apart. The negotiations are always difficult ones. That being said, Arizona and a number of other states are looking at these options, and I am sure we will continue to be looking at ways to structure Minnesota to make sure we get the most money and the best programs that work for the state. We're uniquely positioned for some of these expansions of the early option, and that's part of the reason why you're seeing it in the governor's recommendations.
Senator, to that point? Okay.
Yeah, but
Senator Ingebrigtsen had his hand up, too, but if it's to that point.
Yeah, to that point, but Madam Chair and Commissioner, and maybe when Ms. Jessen, Commissioner Jessen testifies, I thought the ability to seek waivers was such that, and Senator Hamm, maybe you've explored this a little bit more than myself, it is upwards of a six-month period that it tends to take some amount of time. And I know, Madam Chair, you know, the resolution we had the other day on the floor relative to deadlines would suggest that maybe next year's budget we get the opportunity to revisit that, but I'm not sure about this year's budget.
Commissioner Jessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hope it's okay if I join Commissioner Showalter.
Yes, just introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Yes, my name is Lucinda Jessen. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services.
And did you want to respond to the question raised by Senator Hahn about the application for waivers?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Hahn. Let me address in kind of two parts of the question about waivers. First, let me say that actually, Senator, I think I just forwarded to you, probably haven't gotten it yet, a letter that I wrote to the government asking for flexibility in a number of these areas, including the maintenance of effort requirements. From my perspective, I do not think the federal government will, under this administration, will be open to this large blanket waiver that Rhode Island received at the end of the Bush administration. But I do think that we need to ask for flexibility in several areas. I started that conversation with the Department of Human Services in that letter, which I forwarded to you, and it suggested that you should share it as appropriate with, you know, committee members. So I do think that there's some areas where we need flexibility. I don't think we'll be able to, and in many respects, as Commissioner Showalter said, you know, perhaps should ask for that broad a waiver as Rhode Island received.
Chair. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, my experience has been that it takes longer than 6 months. It can take years to get a waiver. We were trying to do the same thing in Minnesota Care that the federal government was giving bonuses to states to do in Medicaid to insure kids. And that was a couple years ago, and we still haven't gotten those waivers yet. So, you know, if you want a waiver, I'm not saying you shouldn't try and get one, but I don't think you should count on a waiver to do your budgeting.
Thank you.
Since Commissioner Jessen's at the table, let's just advance, and we'll come back to a couple of the other slides. But I think there's always a lot of interest in health and human services. And while she's here, we're going to go to them.
Senator Ingebrigtsen also has a question before we proceed.
Thank you, Commissioner. Going back to the local aids and credits line there, we see about a $3.5 million increase. Can you tell me, Without digging up my records, what year are we bringing back the local government aids to what level? What level were they funded at that level, comparison to now? I know we're the first bill that came before the governor, he vetoed, that was a flat line from the previous year. That was the unallotted one that was put into law. Mm-hmm. Are we going back to one biennium here with the $3.5 million increase?
Commissioner Showalter?
I'd have to check for apples-to-apples comparison on a fiscal year basis. Certainly what you're seeing is the unallotments that were taken and then basically struck and then passed through law. That one-time reduction was included in the fiscal year 11 reductions to local aids and credits. There was a separate law that reduced local aids and credits on a permanent basis. In 2012, basically, the one-time reductions went away, and so that was sort of the starting point for the governor's budget recommendations. Looking backwards, see if I can get any help. We will take a look at our detailed fund balance, and we'll find out a comparable year.
Thank you. Do we want to move on to Health and Human Services then?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. As Commissioner Showalter said, looking at the Health and Human Services budget was a large challenge. You know, particularly where you know it's a budget that has over, as you all know, over 30% of the general fund. That 83% of out of our budget in human services goes to provide health care mostly for the elderly and disabled, and that's before you get to the you know, protection of children and child support and matters like that that are close to our hearts. When we looked at the budget overall, we tried to do so with a couple of things in mind, you know, mostly to try and protect the core safety net. We may all differ on what is in that core safety net, but that was certainly foremost in our minds. But second, also to slow expenditure growth, which we have to do in the healthcare budget, or else it will eat up far too much of our budget going forward and leave a little room for other innovative things. And finally, we try to do all of this kind of with reform and fairness in mind. Let me start. I think this first slide just talks about a few of the reform items. You know, first you'll see in the DHS budget, as well as, you know, some of it's reflected in commerce as well, funding, which is mostly leveraging federal dollars to get to draw down a lot of federal dollars to fund the development of a health benefits exchange. And also significantly, you'll see kind of a small kind of 10% match to leverage 90% of federal dollars, which we believe will get us a new streamlined eligibility determination system that will actually save the state a lot of money, you know, in making those eligibility decisions line up for federal reform, and also make this much more accessible to our enrollees.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, before you proceed, I just want to question about this exchange. How much federal dollars are being brought in to do this, first? And then, secondly, when I met with Lauren Gilchrist a week or so ago, one of the things that she told me is that the exchange portion of what the administration wants to do, she said something like 90% of what they needed to do could be done without legislative approval. And I just wanted to know if you would comment on what does that mean exactly, and what is the money going to be, and what are you going to do with it, and how is this done without legislation?
Commissioner Jessam.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand. As far as the money, we just sent an application about a week and a half ago for a $1 million planning grant, which we have received indications, you know, we will receive. We hope we will receive that. That planning grant gets us through the next year. Then I think we have the opportunity to apply for, you know, depends on the dollars and how much they would give us, but, you know, up to $40 to $50 million in kind of a follow-on implementation grant for the exchange. I don't know exactly what Ms. Gilchrist was saying. She was probably referring to the development of the insurance exchange. From the governor's perspective, the governor would like to have exchange legislation, you know, successfully get through the legislature this year that sets out the framework for an insurance exchange. An insurance exchange is something that, you know, Governor Plenty first proposed in 2007. I think that whatever happens with federal reform, I believe federal reform will go forward, but if it doesn't, I think an insurance exchange is a good thing to have. We will be bringing forward legislation from our perspective of what that exchange should look like. I understand there's also other exchange legislation that's out there. We hope to work together to have good exchange legislation. She was probably referring to the fact that even if exchange legislation for some reason did not pass the legislature, which we hope it will, that the Commissioner of Commerce has a lot of the power to do much of that, you know, with, given his powers as Commissioner of Commerce. That is not our goal, but certainly that is available to us if we're forced to look at it.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioners, do you consider eliminating 27,000 people from coverage leading on health care reform?
Commissioner.
No, 27,000 people from coverage leading on health reform. No, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, no, I do not.
Then I hope we work together to fix it.
Madam Chair, obviously there are very, very difficult choices here, and as that issue suggests, finding any way to balance the Health Care Access Fund, bring the general fund exposure on health care cost growth are going to lead to very, very difficult and frankly, not desirable options.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Commissioner Showalter, you know as well as I do that eliminating coverage is not necessary to balance the health care access fund.
Proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me talk a little bit about our efforts in the governor's budget to reform our payment and delivery system for our publicly funded programs. As this committee is probably well aware, state spending on managed care as a method of purchasing health care is growing at the rate. I just asked George Hoffman for these figures between 2003 and projected through 2013, over 12% a year. Now, of course, some of that is due to the fact that there are additional enrollees. I understand that. But that is, a large part of the state budget. We want to begin to get our arms around it. The governor proposes to reduce administrative costs to what will be the lowest in the nation, but also to increase competition. We believe we can get savings and continue to have quality outcomes, so the governor's budget does include a pilot project in the metro area to actually have competition. We believe drive more reform in our managed care system, and also to improve some outcomes. We have some payment and care delivery reforms built into the governor's budget, some pay-for-performance initiatives. We also have in the governor's budget what you will see as a 2.75% non-administrative cost reduction for managed care plans. I have reached out to the plans, to the provider community, to others to say, we actually want to work with you across the next 6 months to come up with new models of delivering care, whether it's direct purchasing, accountable care organizations, changes in the way we do contracting. So instead of basing our contract with the plans to provide this coverage based on what we've done in the past, to say what can we do better in the future to have more pay for performance, those are all things we would prefer do to save this money. On the other hand, if not, we do propose that there be a reduction in non-administrative costs.
Excuse me, Senator Bonham has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jessen, with regard to the competitive bidding and the pilot project, can you just say a little more about that? I don't know what you're referring to in that.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator, what we're proposing to do is have a pilot in the competitive bidding between the plans. In the metro area, where we think that would be the best, easiest place to do it at first, we would need at least two plans, have at least two plans, involved, two managed care organizations. But right now, the way our program works is we do the contracting with each of, with each of the plans. Here we're saying maybe if we have them compete for our business, that we will get better prices, assuming, of course, that they also meet our quality outcomes. We need to keep both quality and price in mind here.
Senator Bonham.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, so are we going to open up the current contract that we have in place, or when, how are we going to have the ability to deal with that?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonham, this would be we would not be opening up the current contracts to do this. This would be starting for contracts that would start in calendar year 2012. Let me just note that the governor's budget does include continued funding for the statewide health improvement program, which are our population initiatives, which we feel are important as we go towards health reform, that we not only need to look at the health, the payment side, but also kind of the population initiatives that get us all to change our behavior so that we're both healthier and save us all money in the long term.
Commissioner, was that set in current law as a grant program that was set to expire and then is being renewed now, so it's considered new funding?
Madam Chair, my understanding, and Commissioner Showalter, I'm sure will wait, tell me if I'm wrong about this, was one-time funding by the legislature. So we are The governor is proposing that that funding be continued at $20 million a year during the next biennium.
Do we have or could we get in the future information about where those grants went and what they were used for?
Absolutely.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
I'd like to see that. Is that what you're going to ask? Okay. Anyone else?
We're also recommending continuing the base funding, which is about $2.5 million, so that for the health department's continued efforts to report on healthcare costs and quality. As we move towards a system where we want employers and individuals to be able to choose their health care based upon cost and quality, we need more transparency. And so we believe this is important to get us where we want to go on health reform. And finally, you'll see a matter in the budget that provides kind of, once again, that smaller state match to leverage federal funds so that we can get millions of incentive dollars for our hospitals and other providers to develop electronic medical records for our Medicaid programs.
Commissioner, how many hospitals still haven't reached that level that they have some electronic health record technology?
Madam Chair, I don't have the exact number here, but I must say I've been surprised when you look at not only hospitals but also, you know, providers, including many, you know, small rural clinics that do not have this yet. And there are federal incentive dollars that I believe are part of that High Tech Act that are available that we're trying to get to them.
So have we provided a state match for those federal dollars then? Is that what that is?
What this, Madam Chair, what this is actually is the dollars which to provide for state oversight. In order for the providers, our Medicaid providers, to get these federal incentive funds, there needs to be state oversight. So these dollars provide, you know, are the state match for the state oversight. So it's really just the oversight that allows the providers to then get the money from the federal government.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, we have in the past made loan and grant money available for this purpose, and the loan money was intended to come back into a revolving fund. I'm wondering how much money is in that fund.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't know the answer to that, but I will find out.
Seat, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the Commissioner Showalter said, there were many very hard decisions we made in the Health and Human Services budget. I want to just highlight a few of those for the committee, many of which you've probably heard about even in the press, as well as from the governor's rollout of the governor's budget. Our values, we tried to protect access to health care for people with the lowest incomes. I think this is a continuation of what the governor did with the early expansion of MA. So while we are continuing coverage for all children and adults with incomes at 200% of the poverty or less, the governor does propose to eliminate Minnesota Care coverage for adults with incomes above 200% of poverty. I must say this was a very difficult decision to make. This affects about 7,200 individuals on Minnesota adults on Minnesota Care, and the reason we chose 200%, if we, you know, have to make these reductions at all, is it does put us in line with federal reform, which will enable the state to do a basic health plan starting in 2014. So while the maintenance of effort would have allowed a state to declare a budget deficit and perhaps go lower than that, we felt that at least we needed to do this. It was a very troubling, hard decision.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonhoff asked me what the 200% was, and I don't know either. Could you just tell us in dollars? Percentages get me confused, Commissioner.
Commissioner.
Just plain straight dollars.
Madam Chair, Senator, for a family of four, 200% of the poverty level is about $44,000 a year.
$44,000? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, it's about $21,000 for an individual.
That's what?
And I don't think even you believe that someone at $21,000 can go buy private insurance.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Commissioner, can you tell us what is the savings that are being put into the budget as a result of eliminating the adults' incomes about 200% of FPG.
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, Commissioner Showalter is looking at the exact number. I believe it's about $33 million. Yes, $33 million.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, you know full well this slide is not correct because it also, that amount of money is eliminating coverage for about 20,000 children as well. And it isn't necessary to do any of this. This fund can be balanced without taking people off of coverage. And I, for one, do not believe, I know there'll be casualties along the way because of the budget deficit in the general fund. There does not need to be casualties left along the road because of Minnesota Care.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. We had passed recently through the Commerce Committee a proposal to deal with adults without children in Minnesota Care that would provide a stipend to purchase insurance in the private market that would save about $50 million a year. Is that an alternative that the administration would consider to the elimination of some of those people from having coverage at all?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Hand, you know, I think the governor has been clear that, you know, that he is open to many ideas on the way to achieve savings while protecting the most vulnerable, protecting health care wherever we can. If I may, Madam Chair, as far as 20,000 children being affected by the Minnesota Care, this Minnesota Care eligibility reduction, you know, I'm not sure where Senator, you know, the rationale for that number. I'd be happy to talk with Senator Berglund or anyone else about that afterwards. I understand that this is a very difficult decision, and we would welcome other options or alternatives to deal with this.
Commissioner, if someone is on Minnesota Care and is at, you know, like 190% of the federal poverty level, what kind of a copay would they be paying for their insurance? I mean, there is a copay at that level, isn't there? It kind of ratchets up with income level.
Madam Chair, yes, the Minnesota Care program has sliding scale premiums. You know, that depend. You know, in addition to some copays, and those sliding scale premiums depend upon the family income.
Please proceed.
In looking at both the protecting the safety net and slowing the expenditures, we also thought it was important to manage growth in our long-term care programs. These, of course, are some of the most important programs in the department. We did so in where we could by extending the current caps on the disability waiver growth. We also tried to where we to establish a medical needs threshold for congregate living and to implement targeted rate reductions and some higher eligibility requirements. Basically, what we're trying to do is target the dollars used in this area to those folks who need it the most. You will note also in our budget that we did, looking at the budget as a whole, try where we to protect the core safety net services for children and vulnerable adults. As Commissioner Showalter said earlier, there are reductions to counties in this budget. We tried to prioritize those to protect mental health spending wherever possible. And, you know, even where we made reductions to say, in some of those places to say, okay, we want you to focus, instead of doing everything you were doing before, focus those dollars and those efforts on child protection and adult protection functions. This proposed budget does restore the funding the legislature did not provide 2 years ago to fully fund adoption assistance. It also continues general assistance, cash assistance. I point that out. One, because, you know, I know that's been an issue in the past. And it, once again, is, I think, an example of what we were trying to do to protect the safety net, including protecting it for people who don't always have all the lobbyists around the capitals and those who need it the most. We also, in looking at this budget and overall the budget, the governor's budget tries to protect individuals wherever possible. And we asked our service delivery partners, the hospitals, the health plans, as I said before, continuing care providers, nursing facilities to share this with us and the burden with us in the difficult times. So this includes rate reductions. We've both increased the MA surcharges by the net reflected here, and this is the net figures. As Commissioner Showalter said earlier, there are the surcharges. Then we also, you know, included MA increases in the aggregate, but that doesn't mean it's exactly for every individual nursing facility, ICFMR, or managed care plan. In the aggregate, that, you know, serves to make whole over, in a very general sense, nursing facilities, ICFMRs, and managed care organizations. It does not hospitals. Hospitals is a little less than half in the aggregate. We also delay the hospital rebasing by 6 months. That's for the fee-for-service population. And in one of the, I think, very difficult decisions in this budget, the governor's budget reduces home and community-based service rates by 4.5% and nursing facility rates by 2%. We are concerned about these rate reductions because while the governor wanted to, wherever possible, to protect the most vulnerable, and his budget seeks to do that, we understand that sometimes at some point when you cut provider rates, if enough providers aren't there to provide the services, you are impacting vulnerable adults, vulnerable children and adults. So we're concerned about this. We added an evaluation component into this budget. We're paying for an outside evaluator, especially on the home and community-based service side, to assess how this has impacted access for our enrollees. And certainly that report will come to the department, the legislature, so we can assess the impact of these proposed rate reductions going forward.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, you shouldn't need a study to know how many state-operated services will close. You know, how many will be under the 4.5% reduction.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, sitting here today, I do not. We're
I believe it'll be around 30%, and I don't know where those people are going to go.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I do not believe it will be 30% of state-operated services.
I'm talking about the group home part of state-operated services.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, forgive my foolish question. Could you explain inpatient hospital rebasing? I don't know what that is.
Commissioner.
Certainly, Madam Chair, Senator Newman, rebasing basically tells us what the cost, you know, every 2 years we should look at the actual cost basis for the hospitals who participate in our fee-for-service program. I think 2007 was the last time rebasing was done. This delays that rebasing for six and pushes it out 6 months.
Commissioner, could you explain the MA surcharge to me a little bit? Because the hospitals or the health providers aren't going to absorb all that money, so how is it going to be recaptured?
Madam Chair, in general, we impose the surcharges, and then the idea is to increase our medical assistance payments. And when we increase our medical assistance payments, the state pays half of those, and the federal government pays half of it. So it is a way allowed by federal law to kind of capture some federal funds. The challenge is, while then in the aggregate, as I was saying, in the aggregate, let's take nursing homes for an example. Nursing homes, we might say, well, we're going to put on a surcharge but increase our MA rates and so capture those federal funds to cover half of that. The challenge is that it applies a little unevenly. That's why I was talking about an aggregate. It can make the industry whole, but it applies more where nursing homes that serve a greater medical assistance population are going to get more of those rate increases. It depends on the beds, you know, that they have vacant or not. So while it serves a purpose in one we're trying to use here to get more federal funds to help us, you know, serve to deal with this very difficult budget deficit, you know, we're the first to recognize it is not, you know, an entirely even process. For an example, with hospitals, we'll do the surcharge, we're doing, and then kind of the rate increases. As I said, we're not increasing the rates to even in the aggregate to cover the full hospital surcharge, but for those who qualify for a little less than half of that kind of Minnesota assistance rate increases, you know, there's some hospitals that do a lot of MA business, and those hospitals benefit more, and there's some hospitals that don't do nearly as much MA business, and so they are going to feel the brunt of the surcharge more. I mean, Commissioner Showalter, maybe, is there anything you want to add here?
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, how are the HMOs that are going to experience the surcharge getting reimbursed under your methodology?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Berglund, as I understand it, the managed care organizations will, you know, in the aggregate, receive rate increases to cover this. I don't know the exact, process and how that'll work. I'm happy to get back in more details with you. I did actually meet with the Minnesota Council on Health Plans yesterday to work through a number, hopefully, of these issues.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I think this part of your proposal is very problematic. You know, there'll be some HMOs that are very, very, very big winners under this, and there are some that will be very, very, very big losers under this, and there is no way to even that out.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm happy to take a look at that. I must say, when I met with all of the health plans yesterday, you know, they had many concerns about our budget proposal. This was not the major one that they raised with me. That doesn't mean, of course, that they won't.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, that is kind of the end of my overview. I would turn it back to Commissioner Showalter and, of course, be happy to answer any other questions the committee has.
Thank you. Any other questions for the commissioner? Thank you.
Madam Chair, as you can tell, quite a few difficult decisions, and as we continue to go deeper and deeper into the budget, you'll see a lot of the choices that were necessary to be made in order to get even to the roughly $1 billion of spending reductions that are recommended in the governor's budget. I'd like to call Commissioner Casilius up to talk about education so that while she's here, we can also cover that area, because that's certainly a major element of the governor's budget recommendations.
Good morning, Madam Chair, Senators.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. My first time here speaking with all of you, so thanks for inviting us. It's pretty difficult and very humbling to follow Human Services, knowing the major cuts to that area. And really, we know that every dollar here equates to real people's lives, and that these decisions are very difficult that you will be facing, the governor will be facing, and we're all really facing as citizens of Minnesota in the future. With a $6.2 billion deficit, especially in this deficit, a budget really should reflect our shared values and our shared principles. And the governor has promised an investment in education. This was a very difficult decision for him. To keep this promise, but this investment in our almost 1 million children in this state, I think, is something that Minnesotans stand behind. So we didn't come with a long list of investments, really. We tried to choose some smarter, smaller, more responsible investments that are research-based and sound, give us a really high yield on our return for a small investment, but really set expectations higher for our teachers and for our schools in terms of providing some results for our students that we know will equate in a better prepared workforce for Minnesota tomorrow. And so what we started with was early childhood. Some of you are familiar with Art Rolnick's work and the work, several research studies across from Chicago, Boston. And the investment in early childhood paying and yielding up to $16 for every dollar invested. So we started with early childhood rating system and looking at ways to support families and parents making choices for their children so that they could choose quality child care for their for their child. It's a very difficult choice to make to give your child up to child care that early. And also the quality of early childhood teachers, ensuring that when students go, they're actually getting a really good quality child care experience. Because we know that early childhood makes a very large difference for children. We also believe that all-day optional kindergarten is a wise investment to get our students off to the right start so that we can ensure that they're reading by third grade. Learning to read by third grade and then reading to learn for the rest of their lives is a critical skill in terms of future success, not only in school but also in career. We also are coming with a proposal for two new programs, to reward excellence where schools are getting exceptional growth based on our Minnesota growth model. We have several years of data proving that there are schools out there, bright spots that we don't know about, that are getting great results for our kids. And we want to incentivize teachers to be able to share that best practice. We know that it takes their time, substitute teachers, transportation, to get them to share in their school, across schools, and across districts. That, I believe, is really a key to getting better results for our children, is finding where the great work is happening already, and then really incentivizing them to share that great work and build networks.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Senator Magnus has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Could you tell me how many schools have all-day kindergarten or how many don't have, and what that dollar amount is going to be?
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, we currently have 44% of our students who are in all-day K programs, free all-day K programs. 15% of our students are in a fee-based program.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, just to follow up on Senator Magnus's question, Commissioner, what's the geographic distribution of the current all-day kindergarten programs in the state? Is it primarily metro or is it a mixture?
Well, it is a mixture. We do have our metro schools that have a greater incidence, I believe, of all-day kindergarten. Senator, Madam Chair.
Continue, please.
Thank you.
Oh, wait, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the same point, Commissioner, some of our schools, in fact, the district I represent, Columbia Heights schools, have been offering all-day kindergarten even when they were in statutory operating debt because of the serious need in that area with the number of kids we have that need to catch up. So I just kind of get the feeling, do you think that this is a little unfair to those schools that have had to spend their own funds to do this because they know of the need, even though they don't really have the dollars, they've had to divert them from other places to now start funding those that haven't offered all-day kindergarten? Is this need-based funding? Not just need because they don't have all-day kindergarten, but need-based funding because they just plain don't have the money or.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator. It wouldn't be a punishment. It's actually an incentive. What we have is school districts like Columbia Heights who have used compensatory resources or title resources to fund the additional 0.5 weighting for their kindergarten students would still get those funding streams to them with these new dollars. What it would do then would be free up those additional dollars that they've been using in their compensatory or their title funding to then reinvest in programs that they may have had to cut because they've made this other priority investment in all-day kindergarten. I should also note that the all-day cake program, it's optional, but it will flow to you if you want to participate in it. There is an incentive for districts, because we believe that all-day kindergarten is so important, that if you have a fee-based program now, if you apply for these funds, those children in that same classroom and in that school would not have to pay a fee, regardless of their socioeconomic status. So there are some districts that we anticipate that have fully fee-based programs. They'll get some seed money for targeted students who receive free and reduced price lunch. They already are funded at a 0.5 weighting for students for kindergarten. So then they would have to pick up just that additional cost that they would normally have charged families a fee for to cover that expense. We believe that it's a slippery slope. If we believe all-day kindergarten is important, when you start charging fees for what we believe are the essentials to learning, we could get into paying fees for, you know, AP biology or fees for language courses or fees for other services that we say are core and essential.
Senator Bonoff?
Madam Chair, Commissioner, have you considered allowing school districts, rather than using this optional all-day kindergarten revenue, to use it for 3- and 4-year-old programming?
We have considered that as an option. We don't have that in the current language now, but we have considered that as an option that has come to us as a request. And I believe that some schools, like Columbia Heights, where they've said early childhood is a priority, they've seen the research and they believe in it. What they have done, what they would be able to do with that additional funding that they get is provide additional services for high five programming.
I'll continue. Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, why this microphone is doing this.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, why is Senator Hand's mic defective? There's something subliminal in that, I think, for all of us.
Must be my magnetism or something.
David, why don't you move over there and use it?
There's something wrong with the microphone. Maybe if I stand way back, it'll pick up.
Madam Chair, I think it's kind of like a movie where it's you get the ominous music and you know something bad is about to happen.
Can you hear me without it?
I can hear you.
You, Senator Anderson, said.
Yeah, I thank you. No, I forgot what my question was. No. How long has I got a couple of questions actually? How long have we been doing all day kindergarten in Minnesota,
Commissioner?
Oh, I think we've had all-day K for quite a number of years. I don't know the exact date on that. Tom, do you know?
It's always been optional. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's always been optional, and Tom is telling me that some school districts have had it and some school districts haven't. We fund it at a 0.5 weighting currently.
And, Madam Chair.
Or 0.62. 0.612, I apologize.
Chair and Commissioner, I appreciate that. The reason I'm asking is that what we're proposing here, and I guess my concern is we're proposing an increase in funding in a program that we've had for some time. It's not clear to me that there has been the benefits from what we have done that would perhaps justify, especially at a time that we're experiencing right now, a increased investment in all-day kindergarten. And I guess more broadly, the second question I have is, given that K-12 is the biggest part of the general fund budget, there really are no reductions being proposed by the governor, although in Health and Human Services, which we just talked about, which is the second largest part of the budget, there are significant reductions. And my question is, why wouldn't there be a more balanced approach here to look at reducing expenditures in K-12 rather than increasing them, particularly in an area that I think it's at least to my knowledge, has not demonstrated what we've done so far, would say this really is a high priority, a need to invest more money to do what we have been doing is maybe fine, but I don't know that you've seen a lot of information that says this has been the thing that is really the silver bullet, if you will, or something that really should be targeted with the scarce funds that we're dealing with right now. Could you talk about what the thinking was to set the priorities in that way?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator, the priorities for all day K, one is a promise from the governor to deliver on a promise. Secondly, with 44% of our students already in all-day K, we know that it absolutely does make a difference for children. There is plenty of research, I'd be glad to provide it, to show that all-day K does really support children, especially our most neediest children who come to us with having lost opportunities. And so this can absolutely bridge the gap. There's also evidence that early childhood plus all-day K together makes quite a big impact on success for children later in life. So I'd be glad to provide some of those studies for you to be able to show how it makes a difference in children's lives.
Madam Chair, Senator Commissioner, and I am aware that there are studies, but there's, in my opinion, there are mixtures of studies that some may not be as optimistic. But I'm just looking at, given the experience that we've had in Minnesota with doing this for a period of time, and as you say, we've got 44% of kindergarten kids, we ought to be able to say, well, there's been improvement in the achievement gap, but there hasn't been. So my point is that it's not clear to me that a further investment, particularly at this time, in an optional program and some of the things you're describing, what I'm struggling with is saying that's a priority, but we also are looking at making reductions, and we're doing many of them in health and human services, but really none in K-12. And I'm just trying to understand why the priorities are set that way. I understand the governor made a promise, and he also made a promise not to to buy back the shift, but we're not doing that. So I understand we make promises. Sometimes we can't keep them once you see the reality. But I'm just wondering why we're not seeing some more innovation or reform pieces for education that might result in reducing some of the costs, rather than saying, well, we're going to look for cost reductions only over here in this part of the budget.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, I appreciate your comments, and I don't want to seem defensive. We have made some reductions, and we do have proposed reductions in the K-12 area. I can provide those as well. The agency is taking a 5% cut. We've eliminated some tests. We've eliminated some programming. We've capped programming. We've done some different methodology around our shift. We've looked at eliminating magnet school grants and new startup money for charters and things like that that we believe the federal government isn't within the president's plan. So hoping that we'll be competitively aligned to secure some of those fundings as well to match. In terms of the innovation and spawning innovation, I'd like to respond to the other two programs that we are hoping will spawn the innovation. I started talking about the Governor's Education Excellence Award, which is, I believe, going to spawn a lot of innovation and a lot of creativity with our teachers, and also really lift their spirit to share their best practice about teaching. I've always said part of this work is inspiring adults because they create the conditions for children. And so I believe that we have to reward high performance and get them incentivized to be able to share that best practice through those awards. The second piece of that, though, is the specific it's a smaller amount of money because of the deficit that we're in, but it's a specific amount of money to spawn innovation around technology specifically for closing gaps among students who have had a history of underperformance. And so we believe that that small investment will actually give teachers the ability to work together on new solutions to the chronic problem of underachievement. So those are two other programs. And then just finally, I'd like to mention that I believe Senator Hahn, Madam Chair, and other senators, there are some things that we can do within the department just to reinvent ourselves to better support teaching and learning. And we are committed to do that. We want to provide better service to teachers. We want to get our support closest to the classroom and students as possible as we can. And we believe we can do that within the means that we have, even within a 5% cut to the agency. And so we are committed to reinventing ourselves to better support schools. I think we can definitely work with what we have here to spawn some new innovation around children's learning and get some better results. Thank you.
Well, is that the completion of your presentation?
That is.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for joining us. Commissioner Showalter.
All right.
Senator
Ingebrigtsen. I'm sorry. Commissioner, if I could ask one more question. Being a rural legislator, it's always been a little troublesome to me, and maybe you can help me understand this, the disparity between rural reimbursements for students versus metro. Now, I know there's a very large disparity there, and I'm just wondering if you can explain that to me, how long we've been doing that, what the results are showing, and if in fact there are more dollars going there, what kind of incentivizing are we doing for those schools that are doing the same job for less money?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator, It's very concerning to me, too, as I travel around greater Minnesota and I hear the unique needs and the difficulties that they have. I was just up in Perham. We heard this again in Moorhead yesterday, that schools are having to cut legacy programs, that we have this over-reliance on property taxes and referendum and whether school districts can pass referendum or not. I must tell you, as a superintendent and a teacher and a principal, and having to go out and door knock and beg for money for kids is very difficult for us in the public education as well as for communities. And so what we want to do is establish a commission, a working group in the next several days here to look at this reliance that we have on property tax for funding and referendum and levy, compensatory aid, concentration integration aid, all of the things that we know are going to come up in discussion, to make sure that that discussion is very well informed and in how it best meets the needs of children and our priorities and our values as Minnesotans. And I must also tell you that Tom has shared with me a study back in 1993 and 1992. We had disparity among school districts based on referendum and levy aid at about 37%. There was a Supreme Court case, the Skeen case in 1993, and we had to drop that. And so it dropped down in 2003 to 18% disparity among districts. Now we're back up to 31% disparity over the last several years. And that really does concern me, and I think that's why people are feeling the squeeze. And so having this work group inform our decisions moving forward, and the governor said he wants an aggressive timeline. He wants some of these recommendations by the end of March 31st.
Senator Ingebrigtsen. Thank you. Thank you for that. And so just to better understand the cost per student for the metro versus rural, that is driven by property tax, or is that driven by state reimbursement? Just flat state reimbursement.
Just share that, Tom. I'm going to have Tom share that with you, Senator and Chair, if that's okay.
Good morning. My name is Tom Melcher with the Department of Education. And I would say if you look at the differences in funding between school districts in the metro area generally and school districts in greater Minnesota, there are two driving factors. One of them is a much heavier use of referendum levies in the metropolitan area than in greater Minnesota, and that contributes to a sizable portion of the difference. Other funding in the state of Minnesota varies in part based on state formulas, in part based on federal formulas. Most of the federal funding is allocated based on poverty counts, Title I primarily, or based on special education costs. And those are targeted to school districts throughout the state that have high poverty or concentrations of special education students. Some of those are in the metropolitan area. Some of those are in rural Minnesota. And there's quite a bit of variation both within the metro area and among rural districts on those measures. And then I would also say within the state funding system, we have certain types of formulas, compensatory integration primarily, that are based on poverty or concentration of students of color that drive differences in funding, which are related to needs that have been identified over the years by the legislature in terms of cost of delivering education.
Right. Thank you, sir. Senator Magnus.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Ingebrigtsen, for the question. It's on a lot of us in rural Minnesota's mind. We do that. But, Commissioner, you indicated a 5%, your agency has a 5% cut. How many dollars is that?
Commissioner?
$991,000 a year.
And Madam Chair, I forgot to ask.
Madam Chair.
I forgot to ask HHS if they, maybe Commissioner Showalter has those numbers. Did they have a 5% cut also, or how? And how many dollars is that?
Commissioner Showalter?
5%, and I will see if we can dig up the number.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Proceed, please.
Madam Chair, just so you know, for the record, Senator, about $6 million in central office reductions are included in the DHS budget, and then there's other programmatic changes throughout it as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just double-check on time? Do you want to wrap it up at 10? Do you want me to keep on going? I've got certainly more than enough slides to keep you going past 10, but how would you like to proceed?
I know. I'm watching the clock, too. Actually, I believe the Republicans have a caucus at 10 o'clock, so we probably do have to adjourn at that time. I'm thinking we may have to have you come back, especially for the part that concerns MMB. That is something that would be under our purview anyway, and so we might want to focus on it. I do love hearing about all the different parts of the budget because we have all those bills will come through us eventually, even if we're not on those committees. This gives us a good background for that, and I appreciate it. But I don't know how much time we'll have to continue with this presentation. Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, if we have a couple more minutes, I had a question going back to the commissioner's slide that he interrupted in terms of the allocations of some of the new spending. I don't know if you want to get back to that
right
one.
Here?
We left off.
Yeah, we left this one rather quickly,
yeah,
so
we
this
did.
Might be a good one to go back to.
Excellent.
Senator Cohen,
Madam Chair, my particular question was what the $45 million is for public safety.
Madam Chair, Senator, one of the other areas that we would get to in the presentation is in the public safety area, in particular, making sure that the courts are protected from reductions, and in fact, their funding is stable with a small increase for compensation costs, and as well, there's a 5% increase in the public defenders area. That drives much of that change. There's also a restoration of a unspecified reduction in the Department of Corrections that's netted against other more specific reductions that are taken against the Department of Corrections. So that is the net, some of the major pieces that you see in the public safety area.
Commissioner Showalter, was the Department of Corrections, was that the $27 million that had been permanently cut but had been backfilled temporarily by federal era dollars, and
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Asking for it back.
That is correct. And then basically then we took a specific look at what are their current operations, what are their current programs, and started to reduce from there. So I just a historical context for the members is that as you look at this, you see about $2.4 billion of you're looking at reductions on the spending side and overall the proposed recommendations. Just for context, the last time we had a gubernatorial transition was around 2004, 2005. At that point, we also had a very, very substantial budget deficit, and the governor's recommendations included about $2 billion in expenditure reductions and about $2.2 billion in various revenue shift balance changes from other funds. As you're going to see that there's always a need to balance and try to pull those together. As we work through the budget, some of those expenditure reductions after the last 8 years have been difficult to continue going on through without hitting impacting populations that are obviously vulnerable and have been priorities for the governor and the legislature in prior years. So that is some of the process that we worked through in coming together with the governor's budget recommendations that you see here. I just want to add, since time is short, and there's a slide later on, but we'll come back to it a number of times, is that even though the initial presentation is geared towards numbers, it's geared towards how much is going to be spent, how much is going to be raised, what's the balance, what are the overall priorities, which is the right discussion to start this process, it's that this is the first part of the conversation, that the governor really has a commitment to improving the management and services that are delivered. There are some initiatives within this budget proposal that are specifically called out to try and help change the overall performance and results that you get from the spending that is made in the governor's recommendations and from state generally. And also, I think you're just going to see a number of the commissioners are working on different ideas and different projects to make sure that we can continue to come up with better ways to address some of these programs. Because we know these choices are difficult. I don't think they'll necessarily resolve the tension of resolving a $6.2 billion budget deficit. But I think it's important for citizens and for lawmakers to understand that the administration is firmly behind continuing to make sure that all dollars are effectively used and that they're directed to highest priorities.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. One question I have, and maybe you've addressed this already, but with the anticipated cuts to the departments, what do you expect the number to be of job losses across the board?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator, the figures, I believe, about 770 FTE, roughly 800 people. That's based upon the detail that we come out of the biennial budget system, comparing the governor's budget recommendations in the operational funding compared with what the governor's recommendations are based versus governor's recommendation. I should say that you know this is, again, a comprehensive set of recommendations, so that's regarding the general funded positions. There are other changes in other non-general funds, although they are much less significant. They aren't facing, those other funds aren't facing a $6.2 billion deficit. As we see federal funds starting to get pinched, you know, that's a significant portion of the overall state budget. One of the slides we didn't get to. That is a slice of the general, the overall state operations. As those funds go away, you're also going to see state employee impacts in that area as well.
Senator Goodwin?
On the same point, what do you expect the job loss to be related to the particularly health and human service cuts, but some of the others too, as far as nonprofit jobs, private jobs, because I know that's all connected to the services that we provide. So do you have any estimation of what that'll be?
Commissioner Shalter.
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't. And historically, we haven't tried to estimate that. We can see what we can do, but I'm not sure how entirely we would address that. You know, overall, obviously, the governor's trying to make sure that he's protecting jobs as much as possible, and there will be an impact on all of the service delivery systems that are affected here.
Thank you.
Well, I think we are at a breaking point right now, and we will work with you and bring you back next week probably. And thank you, members, and thank you to Commissioner Showalter, his staff, and the other commissioners who came today to present to us. And at that, the meeting is adjourned.